Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. We're excited to have a special guest with us on today, Phil English from Temple University. Dr. Philip English is a professor of finance at Temple University's Fox School of Business, with over 20 years of teaching experience across undergraduate, graduate, and professional programs. He holds a PhD from the University of South Carolina, an MBA, an undergraduate degree from Virginia Tech, and is a chartered financial analyst. Outside the classroom, Dr. English has published research on mutual funds and has been an active consultant. However, the reason we got to know Professor English better has been with some of the recent work that he's been doing during his sabbatical, research on CRE market liquidity, something we're going to dive very deep into on this podcast. So, Phil, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolute pleasure, Cole. Delighted to be here.
All right, Omar, I'll turn it over to you to kick us off.
Sure. So, Phil, it's really great to have you on the show with us. We've been spending a lot of time with you over the last year. But so that our listeners have a better understanding of who you are and where you're coming from, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I'll focus a little bit on how I ended up working on CRE and market liquidity and sort of some background there. But I've spent most of my career, the portion of it at least that was in the academy, looking at things like mutual funds, banking, financial institutions, that sort of thing. And a few years back, somebody asked me to sit on the board of directors for a bank headquartered in Malta. The bank has a big ICL portfolio, international corporate loan portfolio, some portion of which is real estate. And so between that and taking on a role directing banking research, teaching, and outreach center at Temple, I started encountering a lot of CRE topics, as you can imagine. We cast ourselves back to 2021, 2022. Everybody was work from home. It was going to be the office apocalypse, that sort of thing. And just started seeing a lot about that in topics on the banking front in particular. You and I talk a lot. And so started coming up there. Same thing with some of the private equity groups that I deal with in London and talking about things like this issue of how quickly can you sell a property if you need to? How do you get liquidity back out of it? If you're in a world where you're having trouble renewing leases and you're trying to generate cash flow to cover the expenses or the note if you've got financing, how do we go about that? And so that piece started really tying together two or three different threads in my professional life and then in my personal life, or I guess an alternative professional life, wear many hats. I had been running for a number of years a trust that was set up to cover healthcare expenses for somebody who couldn't take care of themselves. And when we originally restructured this trust, we put a bunch of CRE in it for cash flow generation, right? And this was back during that time period when we'd been in a relatively low yield environment for a long time. And so there was also a focus there on, is CRE a good substitute for publicly traded instruments that are not yielding what they needed to yield in order to generate portfolio returns. And I had some epiphanies in that context, things like, you know, when you're at that distribution phase in a retirement portfolio, you don't really care as much about returns as you care about cash flow matching, right? And CRE has been a great source of cash flow matching for portfolios going from very small portfolios, obviously, up to really big ones. And so it was quite serendipitous. All of these things started seeming to come together at a particular point in time a couple of years ago. And that started piquing my interest, particularly on the banking front and conversations that we were having, you and I, and soon to join after you and I, Cole.
And so you joined, you took a sabbatical, and ultimately we dove into the topic, exploring.
I like to think of it as embedded, right? I get to be embedded. It's embedded with the press corps or something like that. I'm embedded in industry outside of the academy at the moment.
And so what would you say was the core research question that we ultimately chose to start exploring?
And I like the fact that you point out chose, because that first like two or three or four or five weeks, it was just brainstorming one idea after another. And but there's just a ton of them in this space. There's a lot of things to be explored, a lot of things that we can think about in this space, so a lot of contributions to be added, particularly as we get more and more data out there. So in this particular one, the paper that we focused on to start this is a foundational paper. It's work that we've got to do both for proof of concept and to understand the data, where we're essentially saying, okay, if we're going to look at a return series generated by transactions in commercial real estate, are there any particular biases that are built into those return series that may be, for example, caused by the fact that properties that sell aren't necessarily representative of all of the properties out there? And if that is the case, how do we then go about adjusting those return series to account for the differential liquidity between things that sell and things that don't sell? We have to keep in mind, too, that just because something doesn't sell doesn't mean it's not liquid, right? It may actually be extremely liquid. It may not be selling because it's got really desirable characteristics, right? Maybe the entity that owns it doesn't need cash, or another thing that'll come up later on, there may be other ways to get liquidity out of it. And I think that's going to be a research topic for us moving forward. Certainly, Cole and I have had some exciting conversations about that the last few days. But so if we've got a return series that's being generated, an index, if you will, you'll see them referred to as TBI or transaction-based indices. If we've got these transaction-based indices, is there something about the way that they're created and generated that makes them non-representative, right? And how do we go about adjusting for that? I want to give a shout out here. I'm not going to do the usual professor thing and drop citations left and right and say, read this paper 2002, that paper 2021, and so on. But there are a few people that if our listeners are interested in reading, have a lot of work in this area. Jeffrey Fisher is one of them. One of the early papers that we looked at, Fisher, Gatzleff, Geltner, and Horan, is a 2003 paper. More recent papers by Van Dyke, Geltner, Van Domini, all of these people have contributed really to the thought process on CRE liquidity and indices that reflect liquidity in different ways. There's three professors at Reading, Amatifi, Devaney, and Mercado, that also have a really, really nice little paper. If you want to think about liquidity and you want to think about it across different asset classes, great little paper. If anybody wants to reach out to me, if you want the actual citations, philip.english@altusgroup.com or philip.english@temple.edu, happy to correspond with you. But that was really the genesis of it, right? Is there something about transaction-based indices that isn't representative, where we need to account for that differences between things that sell and don't sell? And then how does that reflect in different types of liquidity? One of the early papers by Fisher, along with some of the other authors that I mentioned, proposes this concept called constant liquidity, right? And so if we think about public securities markets, where you've got a lot of buyers and sellers standing ready at any given point in time, the liquidity there is constant in some sense. There's always some level of liquidity. And so there's some techniques that we've been looking at and using that were proposed by these guys to move from this transaction-based liquidity concept towards this sort of constant-based liquidity concept. And that's really what this first paper focuses on. Can we learn something about liquidity by the differences between things that sell and don't sell in a transaction-based sense? And then can we make adjustments to these performance indices to account for those differences in liquidity? I think probably a key point here and a really important thing to understand, liquidity isn't something that we can typically measure directly, right? There's no, this thing has a liquidity of 7, this thing has a liquidity of 4. I like to think about it to some degree the same as we think about the real interest rate, right? We don't actually observe the real interest rate. You can't pull out the Wall Street Journal and look up the real interest rate. What we do is we observe the nominal rate, we observe the inflation rate, and we infer that the real rate should be something represented by the difference of those two. Not precisely the relationship, but very close to the difference of those two. And liquidity is like that as well, right? So if we look at a typical transaction-based index, then you look at a constant liquidity index, the difference in performance between those two should represent this difference in liquidity in that market as a whole.
So this is essentially adding context. It's not necessarily adding an answer to the market. It's helping color the and put into perspective, I guess, where we are or where prior periods were. Is that fair?
I would say that's a fair characterization. I'd also add, though, that at the end of the day, finance accounting, all the business disciplines, but finance, accounting, real estate. Normally, real estate is housed within a finance department. Not always. Some schools have their own real estate department, but quite often they're housed within a finance department. All of these disciplines are really about making better decisions, right? And so this idea that you're going to discover some magical, momentous truth that's hidden in everything, and that truth is going to be immutable for forever, that's not the way that science works, at least not the social sciences. And it's really not where we're trying to go with all of this. The ultimate goal is to make better decisions, right? And so if we think about a transaction-based index and how it's developed, in terms of its ability to inform us on how we make decisions, it's going to give us an idea of what performance in the asset class has been. If we've got different property usages or we've got different geographies, how those compare to each other, right? Maybe that's going to decide and dictate some of our allocation decisions. We're going to allocate to certain types of environments or certain types of usages. But liquidity is one of these big pieces, right? If we need cash, how can we get it out, right? And we tend to think of liquidity as a market-based measure of liquidity. If we have to sell it, how can we sell it in a reasonable time frame and achieve a price that is close to value? And if that sounds wishy-washy, it is, right? None of those things are really precisely defined. And we look at, for example, the easy contrast is the stock markets. We look at measures of liquidity in the stock market. Even those are not direct measures of liquidity. And they're often also measures of information asymmetry or the quality of information. Of course, in CRE, we anticipate the information asymmetry will be quite high, right? And so measuring liquidity in that context becomes even more difficult. But when we can tell something about the difference between something that we believe has, for theoretical or empirical reasons, greater liquidity, something that has lesser liquidity, when that those things are at an index level, that measure between there gives us an idea of the reward to bearing that illiquidity. Then as a decision maker, as a portfolio manager, let's say in the CRE space, or even in a broader space where we've got some CRE in it, but it's not a CRE portfolio, we can ask the question that we really want the answer to, which is, are we getting enough reward to justify bearing that extra risk? And that's the key here, is that risk-return relationship and making better decisions.
I love that. It was well spoken, like a professor.
So, Phil, you may rehash some of the stuff you've already talked about when I ask you this, but if we just think about the current market, interest rates are quite high. We've seen some fundamental shifts in supply and demand for key sectors, thinking mostly office, multifamily. We've seen some recent banking sector distress. Why this topic, CRE liquidity, and why now?
So the why now really was just the serendipity of encountering you guys. I'm going to tell a Reonomy story here in a minute, not to necessarily sell the data, but because it really was that aha moment. The why now is as much serendipity as anything. I think there, in terms of criticality, the topic itself is pretty important across a variety of different sort of silos for looking at it. The move towards greater and greater levels of retail investors in private markets, how retail investors invest in private markets. Obviously, in CRE, we've had REITs around for quite some time. We can understand those REIT performance characteristics. A REIT by itself is a liquidity vehicle, right? The whole point of a REIT is that buying and selling into and out of it is easier than buying into and out of direct ownership. But it's also what we call an agglomeration, a big academic word there, an agglomeration vehicle, right? You can put a whole bunch of really big things together and then sell off small slices. You give up some potential advantages doing that. And so we're seeing a big move in the marketplace towards more participation by retail investors in types of investment vehicles that go into CRE. And that liquidity, the liquidity of those investments, of the way that those investments are structured, is important because it is going to be a reflection of the CRE. The Reonomy moment, it was actually the intersection of my own personal investing. I own a bunch of CRE. And a conversation one day with Omar, where we were sitting down and he's talking to me about all this data. And I was like, yeah, how good can the data actually be? Right? He goes, it's pretty good. And I said, okay, so here's an address, the address of a place that I happen to own. That's light industrial mixed use. I said, here's an address. If your data is so good, tell me what you can tell me about this address. And lo and behold, a few minutes later, my name was on the screen as the owner of that address. And I was like, whoa. all right, how about this other address? And it was two or three addresses down into it. Transaction histories, ownership transfers, in a couple of cases, even the tenants that I leased to, just data that I would never have guessed as a researcher I'd have access to. And so it really was an eye-opening moment. An eye-opening moment, by the way, repeated again about a year later when I hosted an Italian group here that does a bunch of work in real estate that are in the same private equity family as the bank that I work with. And they had their own reotomy moment because they were here to inspect some pretty significant size commercial real estate investments here in New York. And they also went down the, well, how good is your data? And guess what? It was in there and they were blown away as well. And so that led to conversations about what's there, what's available there. I think two other pieces I would say from your original setup, Cole. The first one is interest rates are not high. If I had $1,000 for every time somebody said interest rates are not high and I had to say are high and I had to say they're not high, I'd be taking a very, very nice vacation right now. If you look at history in the US, interest rates are not high. They're high relative to what they were in the recent past, but over the longer arc of history, they're not that high. And it's pretty clear that both the commercial real estate space as well as other arenas are starting to make adjustments to this sort of new normal, if it is indeed a new normal. I generally try not to give investment advice for free. I certainly do think rates are going to come down a little bit. I wouldn't expect to see them as low as they were a decade ago. But it's also worth noting that the markets, in the grander sense, the stock market's response, actually as well as the CRE market response, to the possibility of the Fed lowering rates is not as strong as it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, right? A year and a half, 2 years ago, anything that came out that made it sound like the Fed wasn't going to lower rates created a big problem, right? Big reactions in the market. Now it's a more muted reaction. You might even get a positive reaction that it looks like they're not going to cut rates. That means we must not be going into a recession. So I think the market is getting a little bit used to this kind of new normal. The other piece on the why now, I would say, is RTO, return to office. Omar and I and a couple of other friends post-2020, constant discussions. Are we people coming back to the office? What are we going to do with all this empty office space and so on and so on? And I will represent that I have been an RTO person for within 6 months after lockdowns ended. And it wasn't because I wanted people back in the office. I'm sure you're going to get lots of calls about that or complaints. It wasn't because I wanted people back in the office. It's because they were going back to the office. There's too many advantages to it. There's too many disadvantages to work from home. Took a lot longer than I thought, right? But we are seeing that. We're seeing that backflow. And we should be able to see changes in liquidity over this time period as a result of that, those renewals of leases, those reutilizations of office space, and so on. So a lot of things going on, a lot of changes, a lot of interesting phenomenon.
So Phil, we'll bring it back to the actual research. Is there an initial preview of some of the findings that might tell us about the current environment? Anything that really stood out to you?
Well, a couple of things. Turnover, you know, which is a measure that we often see used, particularly in practice, see a lot of use of turnover as an idea of how liquid things are. We know it's a flawed measure, right? We've known it's a flawed measure all along. How flawed is a little bit harder to say. Certainly any basic transaction-based index is essentially a turnover type index. But one of the things that really struck me as we started doing this was the relatively large proportion of properties that never trade. We might have a 20, 30, 40 year transaction history and the property has never traded. It's never been bought or sold. It hasn't been bought or sold in a portfolio, hadn't been bought or sold as an individual property. It made me intrigued enough that I started looking up things like, I live here in New York, the building that I happen to live in, which hasn't sold in the last 60 years, 70 years, something like that. And so if we think about turnover as a liquidity measure, if a large portion of the properties never trade, then we shouldn't be counting them as being part of how we measure liquidity. And it's not because they aren't liquid or because they are liquid, it's because we have no information, we have no way to say, right? As I mentioned earlier, maybe they're not trading because they're fantastic, wonderful, amazing properties that have great yields associated with them. And why would you ever sell them, right? At the other end of the spectrum, maybe they're not trading because there's no possible way that you get any money out of them. you're better off just letting it sit. That the piece there that I always think about is all these abandoned gas stations, right? The cost of trading it's so high that they just don't get traded. And what if we think about
have negative value?
Effectively have negative value, exactly. We've got some properties in New York, some pretty big properties in New York, as land leases come due and things like that, that could arguably have negative value. And so when I think about turnover and I think about that as a measure of liquidity, if 20% of the properties never trade and you're measuring turnover as the proportion of properties that trade over the total properties, that total properties is overstated because they were never available to trade, right? They couldn't have traded to begin with, which means turnover, liquidity is understated, right? You're not actually getting a true measure of the degree to which these things could have turned over. Now, coming back a little bit more directly, that was just a piece that came through in the univariate analysis here. Coming back a little bit more directly to some of the things that we've examined in the context of generating these indices that have different types of liquidity in them. We look at these transaction-based indices, TBIs. When we take the information that we gain from generating those and then transform them to these constant liquidity indices, the thing that I was surprised at was how small the relative difference was. I think there's this sort of logic out there that CRE is very illiquid. If something's very illiquid, then there should be big premiums, big differences between index measures that don't capture the liquidity in a constant form and those that do. And it's not that big, right? 20, 30, 40 basis points. Sometimes in the really down market cycle, they're all pro-cyclical, right? All of these indices are pro-cyclical. In the down market cycles, you do see a bigger premium, maybe 40 or 50 basis points. But I think if you had told me that the liquidity premium for a constant liquidity calculation for a CRE index versus a non-constant, a variable liquidity was only, 30, 40, 50 basis points, I'd have said, no way, it's got to be higher than that. So I think the assets are probably in a return context more liquid than we think they are. Certainly, some of the turnover statistics would suggest that as well.
So, Phil, I think if folks have made it this far into our conversation, they're probably wondering about the practical applications for something like this. Walk us through how an institutional investor might use something like a liquidity index in their process.
Yeah. So one of the big ones when you're looking at indices, and I think there's a tendency sometimes to think of all these different indices that are out there, and it doesn't matter if you're talking about the stock market or CRE, as competing with each other in some sense. And they're not really competing with each other. They're all giving you information. They're giving you different types of information. You should be selecting the index that fits the use that you're trying to put it towards. But the most obvious one here is just performance assessment. How is the particular asset class performing? One of the advantages that we have and are hopefully going to be able to continue to lever is we can push down into those geographies. We can push down into those individual use types, hopefully use types and geographies, time frequencies. And so somebody that's trying to see how their portfolio is performing can use this to do that. Getting the constant liquidity version is particularly important because if we're going to use something like modern portfolio theory, or any of the other types of optimization routines that rely upon variance, covariance terms to tell us when we're getting those diversification benefits, we really need these constant liquidity type indices to look at. And so portfolio allocation in that sense and performance assessment, as we get more and more grainy, more granular indices, you can do a better job of that. One of the things that I do want to be pretty clear about, and this is somewhere that we will, I believe, ultimately be able to go, when we start talking about performance attribution in the context of we're looking at a given portfolio and asking the question, what is it that caused the performance in this portfolio? What decisions? Was it the decision to be in this market or that market or in this type of asset class or that type of asset class? That's something that we can do when we get these sub-indices. You can really look at attribution and say, okay, our portfolio that is go anywhere, do anything, it really performed well because we happen to have really good choice in terms of this geography that we went into, or this geography and multifamily or whatever. When you're dealing with indices that are at too high a level, you can't say that. The thing that you can't do with this though, and I think that we're going to be able to say some things about this in the future, it's probably a year or two off. The thing that you can't do though is look at a particular portfolio manager and try to attribute that portfolio manager's performance relative to these indices. And this is a really important point. That's not a good use of these. It may be the way that people do this. They probably do this because they don't have a choice, but that's not really a good way to think about these indices and using them. So I'm going to pick on Omar. I would pretend Omar is my portfolio manager. I've given him a multifamily home in Texas, right? That's what his mandate is. That's what he's supposed to be doing. It wouldn't make sense to judge him against a nationwide multifamily home metric. It probably wouldn't even make sense to judge him against a Texas-specific multifamily home metric unless he's been able to continuously invest and disinvest in the market. And he probably hasn't, right? He gets a clump of money in, has an opportunity to invest that money. Once it's invested, we're waiting for that next opportunity to come along. And so this is the idea of whether or not a particular set of assets is investable. You can't really do performance assessment at the managerial level without asking the question, did Omar buy the right assets at the right time? In order to answer that question, you have to know what assets were available for sale, which ones transacted at what point in time. And so we could certainly, given the data that we've got, look back and say, all right, 5 years ago, we gave Omar $10 million to put in multifamily in Texas. What was available for sale during the six-month window around that time period? What did Omar buy? What else was bought? When those other things sold, how did they sell relative to what we think we could sell the properties he invested in for? That's powerful. It is hard. There's a lot of calculation, a lot of programming. We're gonna really sweat the programmers on that one when they have to do it. But you can build that type of a model, right? So stuff that we've got, good for understanding performance overall, good for understanding performance in some very broad sense, drilling down into specific geographies, specific asset class uses, property type usages, good for understanding performance attribution in that sense. Were we in at the right time, out at the right time? Are the differences between the liquidity measures different for those different asset classes? Are we willing to bear that extra risk, even though it sounds like it's not as high as we might have thought, but not necessarily individual portfolio manager assessment, other than in, as I said, in this very broad sense.
Academia has its own kind of terminology and jargon, but one area that you kept referencing was the research frontier. And so can you give the listeners a little bit of an overview of what the research frontier is, and then the state of play for CRE, and how this research would potentially play into that?
Well, I can certainly talk about the state of play in the context of this research and research frontier. It's a little bit harder. CRE is a very, very big topic, so an awful lot there. So research frontier, the idea behind, you know, this conceptualization of there being a frontier to research, if you will, is that all knowledge that we have today builds upon prior knowledge, right? And for example, in the context of the research that we're doing, the stuff with these constant liquidity indices was done in the early 2000s. And people have continued to refine those measures and refine exactly how we go about specifying the models to generate this constant liquidity index, and then perhaps make an adaptation to the statistical techniques, right? So rather than estimating using some type of regression, maybe we're going to use a time series. Or if we're only measuring it at one point in time each year, we want times in between. There's one of the research innovations would be to come up with a technique for measuring those times in between as a reflection of each endpoint as opposed to additional data in between. So this idea of research frontier, when I talk about it with PhD students, I always put it right in front of my face, but I always use a hand as the example, right? You can think of the tips of these fingers as being the research frontier. And maybe this finger is primarily representative of trying to understand liquidity in commercial real estate, right? And so we'll have a series of advances across time. And sometimes the research frontier is pretty close, right? You've got these different topics, return estimation, liquidity, that are very, very close to each other. Sometimes they're fairly far apart. And we tend to think of two types of research here. We think of research that extends the frontier, that takes something that we already know and that adds to it. Or we tend to think of research that bridges two different streams, right? So maybe liquidity and, as I said, general return estimation. Or valuation, right? It's what we do. It's what Altus does. We're a shop that handles a lot of valuation stuff. So should the liquidity of an asset impact its valuation? Yeah. But in order to do anything with that, we're going to have to be able to measure that liquidity directly, not indirectly, the way that we're working on in this current paper. That doesn't mean that we won't learn something from this paper that helps us measure that liquidity in a way that directly feeds into the appraisal process. But that's what the goal of either extending or filling in this bridging research, this research frontier is. Now, anticipating the question you're about to ask me, which is where does this sort of fit in that context? What we're really doing is further refining a point that currently exists on the research frontier. We're not really pushing the frontier out a lot. What we're doing is looking at something, a piece of research that's already there, full body of research that's already there, saying, all right, this is what we think we know as a result of other work that's been done on liquidity. But all of that work has had relatively limited data sets. It's usually been limited to a very specific slice of properties, quite often very large properties. It comes from entities that represent primarily large institutional ownership, right? And so to the degree that they think of liquidity differently or value liquidity differently, their purchases and sales are going to reflect that differently than the market as a whole. The work that we've done pushes down that size by a lot. So we're looking at much greater range of properties. It also is much broader in the types of properties, much broader in the geography of properties, and the transaction frequency is a lot higher, right? So rather than being stuck looking at years or quarters, we may even be able to look at months. It's an outside chance on biweekly every 2 weeks, but I think we're probably going to be pretty solid on months. And so we are refining that frontier and providing information to help guide decisions in a more timely manner and at a more granular level than what we see existing in a lot of the research that's out there. Now, the other piece, and this is always critical in any academic context, is you have to do this work to do the other work, right? And so if we want to ask questions, like the question that I've told you guys I'm really interested in is this sort of general idea of whether or not a particular market or particular type of property is investable. How easy is it for somebody to invest in it? Reductio ad absurdum, let's say 95% of the properties in New York City don't sell or sell once every 50 years. This is not an investable market, right? Most of the stuff that's here is not for sale. That's not true, by the way. Don't nobody go out there and tell everyone that 90% of them don't sell. But it is actually a larger fraction than you would think that don't sell. And how does that impact investing in the market? Do we have a set of owners, REITs, I'm looking at you, that tend to buy things and hold them for a long period of time, right? Because if they do that, then that has implications for the investability of a market and the liquidity of a market, right? I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it has implications for it. And so when I start thinking about private investment in real estate, or when I start thinking about the investment of private funds and how they're going to go about structuring those investments, we've got to do this work to understand the baseline for where we move then. And it's really interesting. There's a whole host of opportunities here. The other one besides investability that I'm currently extremely fascinated with, and Cole was cruel enough to show me some data on this yesterday and distract me from my current project, is financing liquidity, right? If you've got a really high quality asset, why would you sell it if you can finance it? If you can get the liquidity that you need through financing it, why would you sell it? You wouldn't, right? In some sense, financing liquidity is pre-bonding against future value and future sales. And I think we've got some ways we can go about modeling that. And that's very different from public securities markets. Can you borrow against a portfolio of stocks? Absolutely. When we think about liquidity in stocks, do we ever think about financing liquidity from them? Never. We always think about just the sale, right? If you want liquidity out of it, sell it. If you want to buy it back again later on, you buy it back again later on, right? With the exception, obviously, of the short selling literature. But that's a unique feature of CRE, of real estate in general, but certainly of CRE, that could be something we can say some really interesting things about.
The background on what we were doing yesterday for our listeners is that Phil and I were looking at the Reonomy platform, and we're looking at Manhattan office that had not sold once in the last 25 years, but had at any point had a mortgage, and it was hundreds of properties. So that's going to be another piece of research in and of itself.
Yeah. And one of the cool parts about Reonomy, right, is the map. And so you're looking at the map and the purple dots of properties that haven't sold.
6th Avenue between 59th and 39th was, you know, virtually every building.
Yep. And Broadway, you could trace out the lineup Broadway and so on. And being able to say some things about that and then tie that, again, research frontier, right? It all ties together. Then tie that into the banking literature on commercial real estate. And I know, Omar, you're particularly interested in it. Tie it into this sort of conversation that's going on in banking about disintermediation, right? It's not really disintermediation, but it's substitute intermediation where you've got these large private capital funds that are now cutting the loans that historically a bank would have cut, right? And so how does that affect the banking environment? How does it affect risk in the overall environment? There was certainly a time when we looked at groups like that and we said, we're not going to worry about it because the FDIC and the federal government aren't on the hook for bailing them out. And then long-term capital management came along, right? Not a bank. Still got a bailout. Crisis 07, 08, plenty of things that weren't banks got bailout. And so we have to start asking questions about how that all works into the risk in the system versus the returns to any given asset class and so on.
So Phil, a conversation that Omar and I have a lot is that certainly in the finance world or in CRE, there are metrics we could potentially pull from the finance world and apply them to CRE. I wonder if you think there are other research methodologies in particular that could be better applied to CRE. Is there an interest of yours that might lie somewhere in there?
Yes. One of the areas, particularly in mutual funds, that I've done a lot of work is in survival analysis. So rather than looking at every time period as being a time when something happened or didn't happen, which is what we're doing with this selection equation, right? You either sold or you didn't sell. In survival analysis, we look at the elapsed time between things. And so from the work that we're doing right now in this index generation, it's very obvious that there's some potentially interesting applications in CRE of survival analysis. The name's a little bit misleading, right? It does actually come out of, if you were to look at usage of it pretty heavily, the medical field and things like that, that's where the survival piece comes from. But it's really the time between two events. So you're defining the events. A survival or not survival could be defined as time between sales, how long it takes for something to sell. And so understanding stuff like that is another application that I'm sure is being done in CRE, but not being done as heavily. I would actually say at this stage, it's going to be almost as interesting to see applications coming not as much out of pure finance. Finance really is a stepchild of economics, but out of things like economic geography and urban economics. The most developed areas there on the real estate front are actually the residential real estate, right? Because there's huge policy implications, lots of different questions that can be asked, lots of questions asked about human behavior there. I think in those arenas, because we're getting more and better data about CRE, there's a lot of things that they've done, both methodologically as well as questions that they've asked that we're going to be able to ask. And we are able to ask now in CRE that we couldn't ask before. And so, great example now. What we passed, New York passed, 3, 4, 5 months ago, a new tax relief measure. Centered around office to residential conversions, right? And it wasn't like there were a shortage of office to residential conversions already being proposed. But of course, now you've got another boom in them. I saw a piece the other day, I think 5,000 units coming online in the next 6 or 9 months. And we can start asking questions, right? Does it make sense for a particular type of CRE to be converted? What is the time to conversion, right? Turnover is inherently a survival statistic, right? How is that turnover actually represented, right? If you've got one property that sells every year for 10 years, that's quite different than 10 properties that sell once across that 10-year period. And those time differences are there. So Yeah, I think there's a lot of statistics work that can be done. We would say econometrics. But for me, the more interesting applications are probably not going to come out of the pure financial markets. They're more likely to come out of the economics literature than the finance literature.
A bit of a spin-off question there. Do you think better understanding of either liquidity or the metrics and the underlying drivers of real estate, do you think that there'll be a shift in market structure? I know I'm now asking you to take off your academic app, put on the kind of the almost fully management. Yeah.
I was going to say, I had a little bit to walk across my don't give investment advice for free line. So I think that the place that I would be looking for potentially big in innovation is in some type of a REIT-like space, right? The REITs are already out there. We know what they look like. We know how they perform. We've got a pretty good sense of the way that they deliver value to their underlying investors relative to other types of closed asset classes or tradable asset classes that aren't directly securities. I think looking for new products in that arena, and frankly, new risk management vehicles in that arena, as we get more and better data, that should become easier to do and more likely that we'll see it. And so thinking about things like derivative products that allow entities to manage risk in their CRE investments. The other one, and this is playing away from where part of my paycheck is, the banks, probably because of the extreme level of regulation that they face, the banks aren't doing a great job of innovating on a lending front in commercial real estate. And you've got a lot of very large, very sophisticated players now in the private investment space there, where it wouldn't surprise me a bit to start seeing some really interesting vehicles marketed and sold there. As they get more and more data, as we get more and more data, our understanding of those sources of risk and return, of cash flow generation, of liquidity, which is the thing that we're primarily talking about today, should enable the creation of different types of investment contracts on those assets. Like an easy one to think of is a set of contracts that act like an IOPO strip on a bullet loan, right? And one group of investors is contracted for a future large bullet payment that looks like the payback on a PO in the CMO markets. And the other set of investors are getting the cash flows in between now, the IO strips, right? But you've really got to understand what that future pricing looks like. You have to understand how you're going to access that PO piece in the future in order to be able to sell that.
It's like a standardized OPCO, PropCO structure, which
right.
Divvied up shares in each. That's cool. I like that.
And how do you slice and dice it? That's been the thing that direct investment in CRE hasn't seen, in my observation, quite as much of as you might see in these securities markets, is the slicing and dicing.
Yeah.
Right? And how do we go about getting those pieces? And one of the really interesting intertwined bits in that is this financing liquidity issue, right? Because the last thing you want to do if you have a really high quality property is sell it because you got to make a payment to somebody.
Yeah.
Right? What you want to do is finance it and then make the payment with that cash flow. I'd love to understand, and I suspect this is part of where we may go in the future. I'd love to understand what specific differences and characteristics exist for these properties that have very low turnover. What is it about those properties that causes them to have low turnover? When I walk up Sixth Avenue or if I walk up Broadway, this is not a homogeneous set of buildings, right?
Yeah.
You've got glass and steel towers right next to pre-wars, right next to 50s era office building, just very different things. So is it solely the location along that corridor? I find that hard to believe. Is it proximity to mass transit? There's a bunch of work out there on rental rates for proximity to mass transit in housing. It may exist in office as well. I don't know. Actually, it does. Remember when we were at Ares? I'm going to put in a little punch for Ares. Anybody out here who's interested in practitioner research and the practitioner feedback on your academic research, Ares is a very interesting, I choose that word intentionally, place to go. There was a paper, wasn't one of the papers from some of the Japanese researchers about rental rates near developed transit hubs in Tokyo?
I believe so. Yeah. If we find the link to the paper, or we can probably direct listeners to it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there is some work out there, but understanding that, just understanding why they don't trade. My building was converted to residential. It used to be the headquarters of U.S. Steel in the 1980s and hasn't been sold since then. Why? Diagonally across the street, building built exact same era, back street, building built exact same era within years of each other, has traded, I think, 4 times in the last 10 years, including being bought and sold by some really big names. So you just kind of look at it. Why this one? Why not the other one? What's the difference between the two of them?
So Phil, we got one more question for you, and this is something we ask everybody that comes on the show. And I know you're not squarely within CRE, so you can answer this a number of different ways, but if you could snap your fingers and change something to the industry, what would it be?
Oh, I'm an academic man. It would be more and better data, right? A standardization across legal jurisdictions for the way in which information is disclosed, right? The biggest one for me there, obviously, given what we do, is transaction data. But the fact that there's no standardized way of reporting all of this data, every county's different, every state's different. Sometimes it's different for different recorders in the same county. I'm an academic man. Better information leads to better decisions. That's what I would love to see. Of course, the other side of it is information is power, and nobody's going to reveal information that they don't have to reveal if they can derive value from it. I don't expect to see my finger snap be fulfilled anytime soon.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for being with us. And we've really enjoyed working with you. Looking forward to continuing our research in the future here. But I do think that's all the time we have. I want to thank you for joining and our listeners for tuning in. And take care, guys, until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.